Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Bob Ashley, who is the editor of the Herald Sun in Durham. Bob, we've had you, when you first came, we had you for a preliminary report after a few months on the job, but now you're getting to be an old-time Durham editor. You're the old editor.
I am the old editor. It's getting increasingly hard to dismiss my ignorance as being the result of being new.
No excuses about being new on the job. Right. On the other hand, what a great time for a newspaper man or woman to be on the job in Durham, because there has been no shortage of news in this area.
Well, you know, historically Durham has no shortage of news, but the last couple of years have been a bumper crop. There's no question about that.
The bumper crop of news drove the news of the I should have written this question out because I don't want to call it, you know, your takeover massacre, but all of that, you know, from the times of the beginning where you all were the front page news, and now nobody talks about that anymore.
No, that became history as we knew it would, and as these things always do.
Do they really? Do they always?
Essentially. We're not the first market in the country where a newspaper has changed ownership and had some critical coverage.
Looking back, and for instruction, there are other times when a new regime takes over, and in a university or in a business or in a governmental unit, where there are people who have affection for and an interest, both financial and sort of, you know, just an intellectual or other interest in the old regime, and they mourn the passing. So what are the rules about doing that? You just come in, act quick, and then move on?
Well, that was certainly our thinking, that it was better to do it quickly than it was to drag it out, and I think that was the right call. I mean, people can debate, have debated, will debate, you know, in case studies, I suspect, for years to come, you know, whether there are a couple of things that we might have done differently in terms of the abruptness and some would argue the harshness, although I would disagree with that, of the way it was handled. But essentially, lots of folks, I think, either understood or came to understand that doing it quickly and getting it behind us quickly was the best way to move on. I mean, we have a mission every day, and that is to provide the best news coverage we can, an editorial commentary and entertainment for folks in Durham and Orange and surrounding counties. And the quicker we got our internal squabbles off the front page or off the TV screen, as you will, and went on about our business, the better off we were going to be. And I think that's what we've done. There are some people who will forever mourn, as you put it, what happened. And I understand that. People who were deeply involved or personally connected with some of the folks, haven't forgotten it yet. But an awful lot of people, actually fairly quickly, said, you know, whether they agreed or didn't agree with what we did and how we did it, knew that life went on, and you know, we're a major force in the community, and people deal with us on a professional and reasonable basis.
It's a funny thing for me to, as an outsider, to watch the way different people handle different challenges. Mm-hmm. When there is a piece of news that is at least bad news to some people, and I don't want to, I think it's a stretch to compare the management of the Herald Sun's change in ownership with the management by Don Beeson, the wonderful lobbyist who got caught up in the Black scandal. But many people in Don Beeson's situation would hang on forever and let these things drop piece by piece by piece. Well, recently he announced that he's just severing ties, giving up the lobbying
business,
and doing it in all one fell swoop. Right. I also noticed he's being advised by a public relations firm, and you can hear them saying, "Do you want? You know, this is what's going to happen. Do you want to read your name in the newspaper for the next 6 weeks, or do you want to just do it and get it done?"
Right. I think that's a good analogy in some ways. I mean, I think I this is a funny small world story. I think this is right. I think that I've only seen Don once or twice since I've been back. I believe he was manager of WSYD radio station in Mount Airy years and years and years ago when I was growing up and working part time for the newspaper in Mount Airy. So Don and I
have a long
history interrupted by 40 years of non contact, but. I think Don's probably at the point where, you know, his career He could have said it was time to call it quits anyway, just in terms of longevity. And I think he probably made the right decision to say, let's just get this behind us and you know, let's get this story over with.
And, yeah, well, that leads us to, right. or leads me right. to want to right. solicit your views about other the management right. of other news stories. And, of course, the news story where I've heard so many different opinions and so much harsh criticism of the people involved at every stage has been this Duke lacrosse right. story, and then the follow-up story of the Mike Nifon's management of the prosecutorial process. But looking back the furthest, mm-hmm. and then with the benefit of hindsight, how well did Duke University do in managing the challenge that it had? And what, again, looking right, back with sure, the benefit of hindsight, sure. what are the lessons to be learned yeah. from that?
Well, you know, there, that case, that whole saga is, it went through so many permutations, and the art changed so abruptly and so dramatically sometimes that hindsight is particularly dangerous in this one, because it's easy to look back and forget the emotions or the facts that we knew them at any given moment. There are a lot of folks, as you well know better than I, who remain deeply critical of Duke's handling of that. I heard President Broadhead at an alumni event some months ago rather wryly note that there were people who were very angry with Duke's handling of the case in the early days, and then became very angry on the opposite side in the later days, the same people who were angry first for their ostensible failure to act quickly, and then people who criticized them for acting precipitously.
The same people were
same
the same
people.
Offer criticism.
And that's one of the advantages, and certainly newspaper editorialists appreciate this fact. One of the advantages of not being a player but being an observer is that you get to do that if you so choose. I think, by and large, Duke probably handled it as well as any institution could under the circumstances. You know, the mantra now from some people, and including some folks that I know and respect a lot in other areas, is the phrase, you know, they threw their own kids under the bus. And I think that's, again, to ignore some of the context of the time. It wasn't just the charges, although that was very much obviously a piece of all of this. It was the report on the overall, particularly under the influence, performance of the team, and a sense that it perhaps had control issues in the past, and in fact the very real threat of violence and harm to the players had the season, for example, progressed at that point. So it's sort of easy to look back and say, well, gosh, they could have done this, they could have done that. There were some missteps. I think probably all of us were too slow to come to the realization that the prosecutor had no case whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Forget weak case. I mean, I think for a while it became clear that perhaps he had a weak case, but
well,
who would have thought it was completely up? So given all of that, I think Duke, by and large, under the intense and enormous scrutiny that came its way because of what it was. I mean, if this had been any name I pick out will somehow seem, if this had been, you know, John Doe College or you know, John Smith University someplace, it probably wouldn't have attracted nearly the attention and scrutiny that it did. And Duke had to undergo, you know, enormous scrutiny because of the role that it plays in both academics and athletics in the world of major universities. There aren't many schools that occupy the pinnacle that Duke and UNC, for example, occupy in both of those arenas.
Mm. Mm. Well, what looking back at it, what always in Durham, you have to examine the dynamics of race and what with the racial right. overlay, how did that complicate matters for Duke?
I can't speak to how it complicated it for Duke exactly, other than to say that, you know, race is, I guess, is omnipresent in American society, but it's certainly omnipresent in Durham. I had a fellow who knows the area very well the other day say that race in Durham is like beach sand. You know, and beach sand sort of gets in everything, and race kind of permeates at some point everything in Durham. There's a little bit of exaggeration, but it's there often. Clearly, I think lots of people in this had to be mindful of the fact that there was considerable skepticism in the minority community that justice would be done, given the nature of the players, and given, I don't mean the players as in lacrosse players, but the players as in the players in this drama, tragedy, whatever it is that unfolded, was there. And I, you know, early on, you may recall that one of the reports faulted the Duke management team, as it was responding for this, to this, for having virtually no African Americans in the inner circle of the president's management, crisis management group. Again, it's easy to forget that in the early stages of this, Duke was being criticized for being too, I don't want to say blind, because that's too strong a word, but perhaps not mindful enough.
They were being aggressive enough
aspects.
Of cleaning up their own house
right.
and taking care of these
right.
guys and disciplining them and
exactly.
taking
so,
care of the
right.
Lacrosse team
yeah.
and firing the coach quicker than they did.
So that was very much the pronounced national arc. I mean, you know, it's almost a Daily Show parody to go back and, you know, replay all of Nancy Grace's assertions of absolute fact in this, which were 180 degrees different from one, you know, one show to the next. But that was very much the whipsaw of the early arc of this story.
Let's take a quick break. I'm talking to Bob Ashley, who's the editor of the Herald Sun in Durham, and we're visiting about some of the news stories and some of the tensions in Durham, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Bob Ashley, the editor of the Herald Sun in Durham. Bob, when we took the break, we were exploring, as you must have done 1,000 times, both with, you know, around coffee tables right. and over cocktails and dinner and with other probing interviews from other parts of the media. I look back at the, at what all of Durham has gone through, particularly the folks who had a concern about Duke University, about the lacrosse case. So let me ask just the specific question, looking back at it, looking back and taking the reference with no real criticism, because you've said you thought Duke, on balance, handled it pretty well. But now looking back with the benefit of hindsight, how could you have handled it better or differently if you were the president of Duke?
Yeah. Again, it's hard to say. I mean, I think that the president from the outset, and there's, you know, there are reasonable people dispute the strength or the power of this, acknowledge that this was in the had gone into the criminal justice system, that there was a presumption of innocence until otherwise, and that Duke was not going to try to preempt the unfolding of the judicial system. Again, I think, you know, Duke is the 900-pound gorilla in Durham. And I think there was considerable suspicion in parts of our community. I can't really speak to nationally, but parts of our community, had Duke appeared to come in and try to intervene strenuously in what was essentially at that point a criminal and a judicial process. And I think they felt that they had to keep some distance until that was done. I think once the judicial process began to make it clear, and frankly not in ways that you know any of us would have preferred, which was, you know, Nifong hanging on for dear life to his belief that he had a case and taking the attorney general to finally deconstruct it completely, I think had it not, you know, had Duke seemed to intervene in that, there would have been a number of folks who would have said, well, there's Duke trying to throw its weight around. And, of course, that was what generated the outcome. I think there had to be, whether it was the district attorney at some point making the decision or whether it was the judicial process working its way through or whether it was what ultimately happened, which was the attorney general, there had to be a sort of a disinterested third party saying this is either a case or not a case. Or Duke would have been perceived by many people as having tried to manipulate it. And I think that was a real, you know, that really put, and once it began to deconstruct, I think they were quite forceful in their criticism of the position they'd been put in by a rogue district attorney.
Well, let me, I want to get to that, to the rogue district attorney in a minute.
The attorney general's words, I might add, not mine.
Good. Okay. Well, we won't characterize that until we explore all of that. But here's something that worries me, and I wonder if it, and I've heard other people express some worry, that because of the 180 degrees turnaround, particularly with respect to the attorney general's declaring that these accused, the three accused athletes
right.
were innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So that looking back at it, we can't help but have sympathy for them and their families and for their colleagues at Duke for everything that's happened, and to back away from all of this, hey, let's examine what our athletes are doing. Are you and the other people who sort of watch Duke, right. have a professional interest in watching Duke, worried that now the athletes and the athletic department and that establishment sort of have free rein to get back into the ballgame as aggressors or because you just can't jump on them anymore?
Right. I think a couple of thoughts there. One is that I have way too much respect for the professionalism of the people involved in the program to think that they'll see this as giving them sort of open season to go off and do whatever they want to. I don't think that's the case. And I think they understand that regardless of how this has come out, there's going to continue to be a higher level of scrutiny on the off-field and out-of-classroom behavior of Duke athletes. Clearly, that in scrutiny is going to be of a different sort than it would have been had this story taken a different narrative line and played out, had there been truth to the allegations. But I think they realize still that it's there. The larger issue probably, it seems to me, and I know there's some number of folks at Duke, particularly in the faculty, who feel this way, is that there are some significant issues about the role of sports and athletics at major universities today that bear scrutiny. I mean, you know, the Knight Commission under the leadership of you know, UNC's own William Friday was bringing attention to that 10 years ago and has continued to try to do that. I think the problem, many people think, the problem only becomes more intense. And that's not to fault major college athletics, simply to say that the concern over the disconnect between the academic life and the athletic establishment is there. That debate was inevitably fueled by the events surrounding the Duke lacrosse cases that unfolded. And I think that's a conversation that's difficult to have in the wake of how this turned out. Because, for one thing, the people who advanced that argument, who may advance the argument that we're out of kilter with the amount of attention and money and energy and perhaps some would argue diluting of standards academically to pursue a major athletic program. Folks who want to pursue that narrative line are pretty quickly grouped, whether they were or they weren't, as part of the group of 88, the professors who were critical of athletic behavior in the wake of the lacrosse scandal. And that's a difficult conversation to have right now, and I think that's too bad.
Well, the group of 88 are now characterized by many as villains and as quick on the draw, professors who don't care about their students and all of that. That's unfair, isn't it? That's an unfair characterization.
I think it's certainly to group them, it's unfair. And I think the ad has been mischaracterized in the sort of the ongoing narrative on this. On the other hand, I think there's some folks, probably even in that group, who would say, well, in retrospect, you know, sometimes what you say in the heat of the moment, in the heat of anger, you know, may not be your most reasoned conclusion.
Well, that's right. But I've heard people.
On the other hand, it was what it was, which was a statement by people from the heart in the heat of the moment to call attention
it's
to what they thought was
as
the problems.
A slam at the lacrosse players in the athletic department in the context at a time when Duke should have stood together.
Right.
On the other hand, some people who I have respect for who read that letter and statement say, you know, just put it aside from the context of this. This statement makes sense, and we're doing the same thing to them as we've accused them of doing to the Duke students.
They were raising concerns that went well beyond and had existed long before the lacrosse case. In some cases, particularly in terms of the way African-American students felt about the campus culture, raising concerns in a moment when they thought that the attention would finally be given to them. And it's worth noting, for many of them, they felt they were standing up for their students, not betraying their students. Mm. It depends on which group of students you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, we can talk about this all the time. Let's take a break.
Okay.
Then we're going to come back and talk about Mike Niphon.
Okay.
I'm talking to Bob Ashley, who's the editor of the Herald Sun. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bob Ashley, the editor of the Herald Sun in Durham, is catching us up with reflections on some of the hot news in Durham over the last couple of years. Speaking of the Duke lacrosse case, how, looking back, do you size up the dilemma that former District Attorney Mike Niphon got himself into? And how, well, let me just, I'll tell you what bothers me about this. I'm a lawyer, and licensed lawyer, and I watched this happen kind of gradually, watching some of the really key ingredients that, looking back at it, ought to have just not only been little signals of worry, but just flashing neon signs that there was a problem there with respect to the development of evidence and the refusal of the district attorney to have any reasonable kind of conversations about evidence with the defense team. And I said, you know what, how am I going to live with myself when I didn't, as an independent person, speak out on this issue from the standpoint of protecting the bar? So I'm, you know, I'm not especially responsible for that, but I feel like, how can I criticize other people for not jumping in on it when I didn't, you know, when I had some responsibility? And I wonder, how does a newspaper wrestle with both its responsibility to be restrained and its responsibility to jump in when it really sees something that's going on? How did y'all wrestle with that, and how you see it looking back at it?
Well, yeah, looking back at it, and you know, one of the dilemmas for us in covering this story was that you know, every other media outlet in the country was covering it too, and you know, sometimes I felt like a whack-a-mole game. You know, what story is going to pop up that I wish we'd had that is going to be in the Atlanta Journal and Constitution or wherever? So it was a bit of a sense of being kind of in the middle of a maelstrom and all of that. You know, I think that in this particular case that lots of newspapers, some of them more so than we did, frankly, developed independent investigatory reports that cast doubt on the prosecution's case. We certainly reflected all the questionable evidence that we became aware of or that the defense team presented that cast doubt on the case. Editorially, we continued to believe for a long time, and I think, again, in the context of the Times correctly, that for lots of reasons, including the credibility of the outcome, that this needed to remain in the judicial system where it was, that the system is designed, in fact, to sort out the very questions that were being debated and argued on both sides, prosecution and defense, in the public pulpits. I mean, the system is there to do that. What I think surprised lots of folks, myself included, is that, and I had this conversation with somebody a while ago who became quite skeptical, but still was not quite ready to abandon the notion that, well, the DA must have something. You know, he's a professional. He's been at this a long time. We don't know all the facts yet. And even as it became apparent that, you know, there were considerable reasons, which we reported and others reported. Again, some of them reported more aggressively than we did.
Let me just jump in. Mike Niphon, a good guy. We thought a good guy who worked for a very solid prosecutor and who, I don't want to say he had the endorsement of his predecessor, but someone whom we continue to have a very high regard for, Jim Hardin, didn't block the appointment of Mike Niphon. So there was every good – I'm trying to justify myself now. There was every good reason to give a little bit of extra – you know, it looks bad, but this is a good guy kind of thing.
And you know, let's wait till it all comes out. I mean, I think that was a lot of folks' view on this. And again, I think, you know, almost an important element of there were points, particularly early in the case, where if Mike Nifong had simply preemptively dropped the case, there would have been a number of people who thought the fix was in, and that was that. Clearly, there were some stages in the middle and end game where he could easily have backed away from the case, and had he explained why, I think would have maintained the credibility of the system among people who would tend to feel unempowered in the system. The mystery, I think, to lots of us is why, well past that point where he could have stepped in front of the microphones and said, ladies and gentlemen, I've reviewed this case thoroughly, and while it's always difficult for a prosecutor to acknowledge that we're pursuing a case we shouldn't be pursuing, that's the case here. Let me lay out the evidence of why that's so, and I would have liked to have taken this to trial for the benefit of, you know, bringing closure through the system. I can't in good conscience do that. To me, the mystery is, and I don't know that we'll ever know the answer to this, why did he not do that? Mm-hmm. Why did he not say, I mean, did he believe, you know, the attorney general said when he chose not to sanction the accuser, in her own mind, she may still believe something happened. I guess the question is, did Mike Nifong somewhere in his own mind believe he had a case? And as incomprehensible as it believes that he could, it's hard for me to understand, other than, you know, the notion that if you just keep putting off the final resolution, some miracle will happen. I can't understand what was going on there.
Well, from an outsider's perspective, but somebody who's deeply involved or has been deeply involved in politics, I just see it all as politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably to a fault. But that's where, you know, my little narrow focus goes, and that is the district attorney is an elective office. There was an election going on, and then notwithstanding that the election was over, there was still the next election to look forward to and to maintain in Durham the kind of coalition and balance between the upper middle class white community and the leadership in the black community, which is itself responsible to a more maybe militant kind of.
Sure.
So managing all of that, I put myself on Mike Nifong's shoes and I said, you know, maybe this isn't going to work out, but we're going to let the court, we're going to let the judge decide it. I'm going to take this all the way through.
Oh, I think that's, you know, absolutely a plausible way to look at it. And I think that you know, lots of folks would say, and there's good reason to believe that was, you know, at least if not the a motivating factor, you know, whether out of idealism or cynicism, I'll let others judge that, whichever it was. But then the befuddlement becomes, at some point it became clear, or should have become clear, that strategy was becoming enormously counterproductive. It certainly hasn't advanced Mike Nifong's chances in the next election. Mm. He's been disbarred and resigned from office. So yeah, that's where the mystery to me lies.
I think Shakespeare could write a great play about
absolutely.
All of this, or would have the great play written for him. All we'd have to do is just put it in verse. On the other hand, there seems to be a wide degree of satisfaction about Jim Hardin's coming back from being a judge to take over the office, but you recently reported on the front page of your newspaper that he's not going to be there much longer.
Right. And we wait with eagerness to find out who the permanent replacement will be, or at least the replacement until the next election. I think Jim Hardin has done a great deal to very quickly bind up a lot of bind up wounds is the wrong word, but I think to really restore energy and credibility for an office that was in danger of losing it over this. And I think they've proceeded, I think probably by Hardin's design, very methodically, very actively. They're pursuing a number of major cases. They're actually disposing of a number of homicide cases that have been floating around for a while, or murder cases that have been around for a while, and they really seem to be. You know, we recently reported that he's brought the staff up to full strength for the first time in a while. He's really, I think he's set the table for whoever comes in, and I think this was probably the governor's intent, set the table for the person to come in to have to worry a lot less about dealing with the aftermath of Nifong's departure and be able to move forward with that that office.
When would the new appointee have to stand for re-election? Would that be next year or two,
I believe
four,
it's
three
next year, but I'm embarrassed off the top of my head.
We'll
don't
check
remember
on that.
The answer to that. Yeah.
We'll check on that. Call us if you know the answer. Call us. We're going to take a quick break. Talking to Bob Ashley, the editor of the Herald Sun in Durham, about things that have come up. The big news, and the question we want to ask him after the break is, what's the future of the Herald Sun, the future of the newspaper business, the future of the Chapel Hill Herald, the future of the media business as he sees it today? He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bob Ashley, the editor of the Herald Sun. Bob, I've been pressing you on Duke Lacrosse case and Mike Nifong, but you got your own set of challenges over at the Herald Sun. Just in the time that you've come to Durham, is it 2 years now?
Two
and a half years. The newspaper, putting aside all the competitive elements of operating a media business in a highly competitive market, the newspaper business itself is just in the middle of, you know, kind of, I don't want to say free fall, but free flowing transformation.
Seismic change.
Yeah. And is it fun or is it just, are you pulling your hair? As you see it now, how are things different for you today than they than they were when you walked in the door 2.5 years ago and you sort of expected them?
Sure.
What have been the surprises?
Well, you know, is it fun? I mean, some people box for a hobby, right? So I guess it must be fun to get pummeled by somebody's fists. It's certainly an exciting challenge. I mean, it hasn't changed from that for me. And doing what we do is still fun. But yeah, I mean, the whole industry, as you well know and as you alluded to, is in just deep transition right now. We're impacted by that. Everybody's impacted by that. I mean, I won't speak to our immediate neighbor and competitor, but I, you know,
well,
their parent
company. I mean, it's quite clear that McClatchy is I don't want to say suffering, but is challenged, and that has
challenged
a direct impact on how the Raleigh News and Observer can manage. Which is a progressive and a forward-looking newspaper.
And a very good market, as are we. And I think, you know, as tough as it is to be in Durham or in Raleigh in this phase of the industry, there are places it's tougher to be, certainly. You know, the major challenge, and doesn't take any great analysis or wisdom to say it, is that the business model that's underwritten newspapers for a century is just shattering. You know, the ability to get 3/4 of your income from newspaper advertising to fund the reporting features and delivery and everything else that we do is eroding as a lot of those advertising dollars and a lot of news consumers are going to online or internet delivery.
So you're losing both your advertising dollars because some of your advertisers find that they can more efficiently get the word to their group of consumers different
Absolutely.
Ways.
Absolutely. And frankly, that's one arena where being a small, you know, relatively medium-sized paper in a relatively small market, you know, we're impacted by that less than some major. But a lot of national advertisers are certainly looking at least putting some of their money into the internet and internet advertising. And while all of us are beginning to make some money from it in terms of the advertising on our sites, none of us is making the kind of money from that we
make from a full page ad
from RLP advertising. So that, you know, the big question is how as users migrate and at what point does the user migration sort of reach a sufficient critical mass that advertisers see value that begins to approach the old print advertising value of advertising there so that we get an income stream from that finances the reporting and the investigations and the photography and everything else. You know, when do we reach that point? And do we reach that point as we try to reach that point, there are, you know, a dozen other competitors out there, you know, Yahoo News and Google News. And
how do you size that up? Because you have a special, I don't want to call it a monopoly, but you have a special resources with respect to the news gathering that is of real major interest to local people. And how do you package that in a way to take advantage of your monopoly and not scare off a bunch of people from using your
I think that on the web as well as in print, for us and for lots of other newspapers, the key is concentrating on that, is our local market. What can we do to report and aggregate and vet news locally? Of course, the competition is coming from all sides now, the alternate methods of delivery are coming from all sides. You've got, if you're interested in international news, you've got BBC and CNN and the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times at your computer screen just as readily as the Herald Sun. Plus, you've got OrangePolitics.org and Joe's blog and the PAC2 listserv and everything. PAC2 email distribution list, because I'm told listserv is actually a trademark software. As you go through all of that, if people are deeply interested in their own neighborhood, it may be that the chatter all day on the email discussion list is their best source of information on what's happening in their neighborhood. So we've got to figure out a way to bring all of those elements together and, again, aggregate it. I think most people will continue to want.
Has anybody done it? Anybody, outside in a different community, figured the key yet?
Nobody's really figured it out. There are lots of people out there doing, I think, increasingly good jobs of delivering local news on a variety of platforms. And one of the things that we haven't done much of, and some others are doing better, is getting more kind of reader interaction and input, so they are becoming the portal for a lot of the discussion groups. If you're going to blog on our site, kind of idea. But what nobody's figured out, to the best of my knowledge, is how to, I think this is how the guys in the green eye shade say it, how to monetize this, which is to say how to, how to get enough money to support this. And a lot of the online reporting that newspapers are doing are still being underwritten by the revenue stream from the old method. It's still our newsprint. It's still the newspaper core.
Well, that is in business, in American business history, where there've never been anything quite like this that I remember. Right. But there have been lots of times where businesses have been through a transforming experience, and the business on which they were built was disappearing, and they were smart enough to use the income stream to get out of that business and to get into another one. Most recently, I guess, the tobacco companies have, to varying degrees of success, been able to use that tremendous income from tobacco to shift into businesses that were not as profitable today but would be sustainable.
Right.
And that's what your challenge is.
In large measure, exactly. And particularly for the publicly traded companies. One of the big challenges in this is that the investor expectation for returns in publicly traded companies is probably much higher.
We're getting close to the end, I'm going to be interrupting you more.
But
I apologize.
I ramble, given half a chance.
So you would see that you all have the as a more or less, you more or less still, you don't have to report to the public? You guys?
We're not a publicly traded.
You're just
our
a family.
Parent company is a family-owned company. They're way above my pay grade. They understand the complexities of dealing with bankers.
There's some family members who want money, but
there are family members who want money. There are bankers who want their loans
repaid. So you're
in
the position of the Dow Jones situation, where you have a family sort of controlling aspect, but you've also got the pressures of economics.
And sort of probably beneath the radar screen, there are a lot of PMGs still out there. And I actually happened to be at a dinner last night Paxton Media Group. Our parent company. I happened to be at a dinner last night for the board of directors of the Southern Newspaper Publishers Association. And what I was struck by, as I was telling one of my colleagues about it this morning, is that probably a half a dozen of the 25 board members who were there are scions of family ownership groups. From the Charleston, South Carolina paper, which is owned by Anderson family.
So they've brought into the family.
The Schertz family, which owns South Bend, Indiana, and some other papers, and the Charleston, West Virginia paper. A friend of mine, an old colleague from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, whose family owns the Hopkinsville paper. There's still a lot of either small groups in many cases, Schertz, for example, or another, and Praxton, small groups.
I want you to come back.
Controlled.
We got to talk about that later. But the question that all of us want to know is, in the 5 years from now, are we going to be able to have a Well, I'll ask you this. The Chapel Hill News, owned by the News Observer, will it be here? Will the Chapel Hill Herald, what can we look for? I mean, that we're treated very nicely to have two major sponsors.
It's an unusual community to be this size and have two competitive newspapers.
You're going to pull the plug on the Chapel Hill Herald anytime soon?
No. And I wrote just a few just a couple of months ago, as was, you know, this is a great market. You can't exhale without some media outlet picking it up. We spent some time looking, quite frankly, fairly closely at how best to serve the Chapel Hill and Orange County community. We've been serving it very well for more than a decade with the Chapel Hill Herald, and is that still the best vehicle? And we never, by the way, never contemplated not serving Orange County and Chapel Hill aggressively. We thought, is there perhaps a better model to do it with than what we're doing? And concluded at the end of that, no. We actually like the way we're doing it now. We think there is, there are some challenges. We have some revenue challenges that we continue to try to address with that. But we think it served Chapel Hill and Orange County, Northern Chatham County, very well, and will continue to. And we are here, and happy to be here, happy to have made the decision that this was the right way to do it, and to keep moving forward.
Okay, well, I'm going to release the arm twist that I've got on you. Now that I've got the answer that I wanted, I'm going to let you go. You're talking to Bob Ashley, editor of the Herald Sun, and also overlooks the operation of the Chapel Hill Herald, the affiliated newspaper in Chapel Hill, and we're glad you're going to stay. Thanks for coming to visit. Hope you'll come back sooner now.
Thank you. Always glad to be back, DG.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.